Welcome, everyone, to episode 365 of the NBA podcast. I'm Brian Toporek, and we have a lot of news to discuss today. Primarily, the 76ers have a new head coach in Doc Rivers. So we will talk about what that means for the Sixers, the trickle-down effect, what it means on the coaching carousel, and we will wrap up discussing the NBA finals. Before we get into that, a reminder that you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some five-star reviews. We are being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Joining me today is a guy who's going to have to work really hard not to get us fired, Morten Jensen. Mort, this is usually where I would ask how you're doing, but I'm genuinely scared to today.
No, I'm doing well. I am just fed up with the 3 a.m. tip-offs. That's my biggest gripe. I love the NBA, and it was so wonderful at the start of the bubble. You know, we had games in Danish prime time. Like, I could turn on a League Pass or TV2 at 7, and there would be NBA games, and that's fantastic. And now I'm reverting back to having a tip-off at 3 in the morning. 3! That's insane. So I want to talk to Adam Silver and basically let him know, you know, when it comes to the finals, just 2 hours earlier. Just 2 hours. It's fine. Like, it's a pandemic. People are home anyway. It's fine. Just help a brother out.
Luckily, I think that's only going to be a problem for you for about 3 to 4 more games. So you won't have too many more sleepless nights.
True.
We are also joined today by a very special guest who knows Doc Rivers very well. Tomer Azarli, of Clutch Points, the Clippers beat writer there. Tomer, how's it going, my man?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me. Can't complain about the early tip-offs like Mort over there, but I'm good. Doing well. All's good on my end.
Yeah, I was going to say, you probably love the tip-off times over on the West Coast there.
It has been beautiful for so many years. I don't even know what it's like to stay up past midnight to watch a game or something. It sounds outlandish to me.
Yeah.
I don't know how people on the East Coast do it.
I moved from Central Time to East back in June. And even the 1 hour difference just absolutely sucks. Like, when I was like, my God, games are starting at 10:30? I'm too old for this. It's terrible. Oh.
Yeah.
God, I'm playing the world's smallest violin right now.
That's fair. I legit cannot imagine that. So I do feel for you. But yeah, all's good on my end.
It's good to hear. Before we get underway, could you let our listeners know where they can find you on Twitter and where they can find your work?
Sure, yeah. So you can find me on Twitter and Instagram, if that interests you, at Tomer Azarli. That's Tomer Azarly. That's my name, my handle. You can find my work at Clutch Points, the Clippers beat writer for Clutch Points. So you can find all my work there on clutchpoints.com under my author page. Just did a nice little piece on the end of the Clippers season, sort of like a wrap-up, who's to blame / reaction to Doc Rivers' departure. A few thousand words. I took a pretty personal approach to that article. I haven't really done that. So that was a really fun one to write. Check that out if you guys, if that interests you. Yeah.
Very good. Yeah. So I'm glad you brought that up, because I before we get into the Sixers side of things, I want to first just ask you about, you know, really what happened at the end with the Clippers here. And, you know, did this dismissal or mutual departure, however they phrased it, did this catch you off guard, or did you kind of have a suspicion that something like this might be coming?
I mean, given the way the season ended, I think once the Clippers went up 3-1, there was a lot of optimism and confidence. And for whatever reason, once they dropped Game 5, it may have been the manner in which they lost Game 5, being up 15, 16 points in the third quarter with about, 15 minutes left in the game. The Nuggets, outside of Millsap and his mini run, looked kind of dead in the water. It looked like the Nuggets were just done in that Game 5, and they stormed back. The Clippers let them in the game. They stormed back. And for me personally, since that Game 5 loss, I just had a feeling they were not going to win Game 6 and 7, because you just gave Denver too much life. Considering they just came back from 3-1 the previous series. So I don't want to say the Doc Rivers dismissal or, you know, mutual departing, quote unquote, if you want to call it that, was surprising to me. I think, you know, I don't know if this is true, but I believe the fact that the Lakers handled Denver relatively quickly and the manner in which they handled them played a part, because you felt like that was probably what the Clippers should have done. You know, looking at it on paper, the Clippers were probably the better team. Well, I should say this. They had a better individual talent. But on the court, the Nuggets proved they were the better cohesive team. And I feel like owner Steve Ballmer in that front office did not believe they should have lost that series. And it, I don't even think it's just the fact that they lost. It's the manner in which they lost. You know, no real offensive system in place. The team looked completely flustered in the final three games. It was to the point where I think we're in today's NBA where obviously you can build a 16-point lead and teams go on runs, but you counter that eventually. You know, everyone has their own mini runs, and it was like once the Clippers went up 16, you knew the Nuggets were going to come back, and by game seven, you knew the Clippers were not going to hit back, because they just it happened multiple times in a row. I just, you know, going into that game seven, I put my confidence level at a 3 for them pulling out that win, because I just didn't see them. I didn't see anything changing rotation wise, because in games 5 and 6, Paul George and Kawhi Leonard had two of the best games individually that we've seen in that series, and they were still not able to pull off those wins. And game seven, sort of everything goes out the window. That's sort of a wild card game where everything can happen. We know that. And so I was like, you know, if Kawhi has a bad game, the Clippers are screwed. If PG has a bad game, the Clippers are screwed. Well, guess what? Both of those things happened. And I was just not surprised by them losing it. And honestly, a bit of that is, well, I'd say a lot of that is on Doc Rivers, because, you know, I don't want to harp. I mean, I guess we will harp a lot on this on the pod, but the insistence on playing Montrezl Harrell a lot of minutes really just it confused me, because there were multiple times during post-game press conferences where I asked him, you know, hey, Doc, how much do you pay attention to lineup data? You know, stats have really evolved completely since he's entered the coaching ranks. And so I asked him, you know, how much do you pay attention to that? And he says, we have 1,000 coaches. We pay attention to everything. And so when you hear that, you're like, okay, so he sees this stuff. He knows. And yet the insistence to play Harrell over and over, especially against Marjanovic and then against Jokic, which was even worse, it's just he – don't get me wrong. Doc is a great coach who instills confidence and trust in his players. But like I said in that article, the summary article, he is willing to live and die by that trust. And he was clearly just – they were willing to die. He was willing to die by that. And it showed. Montrezl Harrell, just whenever they were on the court, there's no other way around it. It was just the Clippers, whether he was out there with Kawhi, PG, or a second unit team, they were just bad. They were just really bad. They were a horrible offensive team. They gave up so many easy scoring opportunities for Jokic and the Nuggets. I know this started out as a question about Doc Rivers, and that's ultimately who it's on. But, you know, dissecting this Clippers loss goes a little beyond Doc Rivers, but I think he's at the forefront of it. I'll say that.
Yeah, I mean, that was my next question, is kind of like, how much blame does he shoulder for what happened versus the individual players? Because, you know, I'm glad you brought up the Montrez thing. That was something that Mort and I were harping on throughout that series, was like, Zubac was playing well. And it just did not make, I mean, objectively, it was like, Zubac is playing well, Montrez is not. Of course, there were extenuating circumstances with Montrez, with his grandmother, and, you know, him having to leave the bubble. And, you know, who knows how that was affecting him mentally, physically. He probably just wasn't in the shape that he otherwise could have been if he had just stayed in the bubble the whole time. So, you know, everything was pointing to play Zubac more, play Montrez less. And then, you know, we get this report after his dismissal from Jovan Buha of The Athletic, where, you know, he specifically mentioned that as one of the big red flags that Clippers management after the series looked back, were like, this was really weird. And this is not, you know, not necessarily something that's going to change. You know, that the article in The Athletic said, like, Doc thought he had an imperfect, flawed roster, and he was just like making do, or, you know, doing the best he can with it. I'm guessing he's specifically referring to the lack of size relative to the Lakers. And like, that's why he leaned so heavily on Montrez, and Montrez had a great season, sixth man of the year. But as we saw in that series, that Denver series, you know, there were teams that could exploit that lack of size. So yeah, I mean, that is ultimately the question, is like, how much of this falls on Doc versus, you know, the players, who, you know, Kawhi was great for pretty much every single game of the playoffs. Paul George was very up and down. Montrez was mostly down. Lou Williams mostly down as well. Like, who's deserving of most of the blame for this?
I mean, even despite all those guys you named that struggled, they still should have won that series pretty handily. You know, in my piece, I gave about, you know, 30% of the blame to Doc Rivers and about 25 to Montrezl Harrell. You know, I think everyone's to blame. There is a lot of blame to go around for this. You know, but I think when it comes to assessing who's responsible, you have to look even before the playoffs began. For whatever reason, and I really can't put my finger on it, because I've asked him this multiple times during the season, the regular season, dating back to, I had a couple run-ins with him in December and one in January, that's sort of, you know, made the rounds on Twitter, where I asked him, like, hey, what is up with playing Zubats the first 6 minutes of the game, and then in the final, what is it, 15, 16 minutes of the first half, you're just running Trez into the ground. And he would do that in both halves. Like, he may throw Zubats back in for a minute or two, but for the most part, he was just only trusting Trez. And so when you're conditioning Zubats to only play, you know, 18 to 20 minutes a game, thrusting him into a 30-35 minute role in the playoffs is something that's hard to do, especially considering he came off coronavirus and was late to the bubble, missed the training camp, but and also had to work on his conditioning again. Zoo was fantastic, and I was one among others who were advocating for him to play more. But at some point, it's tough to throw a young guy out there and say, "Hey, play 35 minutes," when you've never played that much in your career. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of that is on Doc for trusting Harrell too much during the regular season. You know, it's not to discredit Harrell and any of his achievements during the season, but it's easier to do what he did in the regular season when teams aren't really game planning for you. Mm-hmm. and honing in on your weaknesses, and it's sort of like a night by night approach, and especially for this team who had Kawhi miss, I think, 12 games, PG missed about 17 or 22 games, something like that. They needed offense. They needed offense from somewhere, and Harrell provided that. So did Lou Williams, but Harrell was the main guy who provided that. And so when you need that offense, the one thing the Clippers were never going to do is play Zoo and Harrell together. Harrell is a center, a backup center, an undersized center, but a center. And so there's no way they were going to play him together. So if you need that offense, you know, obviously Harrell's that guy. But what ended up happening in the playoffs is, you know, I mean, you saw in the first round against the Mavs, Zoo had a net rating of 25.6, and Harrell was a team worst minus 11.6. against the Nuggets, Zoo was had a net rating of 10.2, and Harrell was a minus 11.7. Jokic was shooting 47% against Zoo and shot 65% against Harrell.
Wow.
Every single stat pointed to Harrell being a complete liability on the court, on both ends. And so it's hard to explain because you would think that at some point Doc would see that and say, all right, I got to pull this guy out. It's not working. And he did lower Harrell's minutes to about 19 minutes a game, down from about 27 in the regular season. But like, if you ask me, I don't think Harrell should have been playing more than 10 minutes a game, because you should have matched him up with the Plumlee minutes. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, go from there, because Jokic was just having his way. And it wasn't even about it was more about the flow that the Nuggets got, because for the first five or six games, Jamal Murray was kind of in jail. Paul George did a terrific job on him, held him to about 36% shooting in the first five games. Which the Nuggets won two of, which is kind of crazy to me that they won two of those games where he shot 36%. You know, obviously he got loose in game six and then blew up in game seven. But it was just Harrell letting Jokic sort of keep the Nuggets in it despite Murray's struggles that really concerned me when looking at it. And so, you know, I think you knew that Harrell and Williams were going to be liabilities in the playoffs. Mm. I think last postseason sort of changed a bit of the narrative because of how those two as the leading scorers against the Warriors, the KD Warriors, the best team of all time, arguably, how they won two games and pushed them to six games. But at the end of the day, you knew these two were going to be liabilities, and that just proved to be true in the postseason. I mean, it was just there was no way around it. Williams was attacked nonstop. Harrell was absolutely embarrassed whenever he got on the court. And another thing that confused me, which maybe is on Doc as well, is that Harrell was most effective in pick and roll situations offensively, and I think that's where Jokic is arguably his weakest defensively. And the Clippers ran very, very few pick and rolls between Lou, Trez, and Trez, whoever actually was a ball handler. They just didn't run enough pick and rolls with Jokic on the court. And so, if Harrell's not scoring and he's getting destroyed defensively, what are you really doing here? What are you doing? It's just my question. What are you doing? Because you can't throw it to him in the low post and say, all right, the entire offense is going to get stagnant, but Harrell's going to go and try and score on Jokic one-on-one in the post. I mean, that's your offense?
Right.
And so that there's just so many different moving parts to this. Ultimately, I like Jovan said, it came down to philosophical differences where the Clippers front office and even media members and fans all wanted Zoo to just be thrown out there more, to see Landry get more opportunities, and that just didn't happen. And if you brought Doc Rivers back, I honestly don't know if that changes, because you know, both Lou and Harrell have credited Doc Rivers with revitalizing their career and really just giving them a chance to become stars in their roles. And if Rivers comes back, why does that change if those guys are back, you know?
Right.
So I think, you know, Rivers being gone is probably the first step in a couple in terms of changes for the Clippers this offseason. And I think it was just time to move on. I mean, you can say that Doc Rivers is a fantastic person. He was a great guy, great person for this organization. I personally, you know, I don't think this team gets through the Donald Sterling scandal as well as they do with anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very important, you know, time in Clippers history. I'm sure you've heard of it, but you know, Doc has often talked about the J.J. Redick incident where Donald Sterling said, "I don't want to sign a white guy to the team," and Doc was like, "Hey, my reputation's on the line here. You're not gonna mess with my reputation. So you sign this guy or I quit." And so Doc was just really a stand-up guy. He was the great guy for this franchise. Really helped change the culture around here. Just build a winning culture. Arguably had his best coaching season during that 18-19 year, mm-hmm. when you know, they had no all-stars. Tobias Harris was traded mid-season. Boban Marjanovic traded mid-season. A couple injuries to deal with, and they made the playoffs. But they not only made the playoffs, but they pushed the Warriors to six games, which I don't think anyone had. They overcame a 31-point deficit in game two. Obviously, they didn't win anything outside of those two games, but it was just the idea of them being fighters, led by Doc Rivers, was not something that anyone saw coming, and so Doc deserves credit for that. But yeah, ultimately, I think it was just time to move on for both sides. 7 years of being unable to get over the hump. There were arguably, I would say, 3 years where the Clippers probably could have gotten it done, and they didn't. Couldn't even gotten to the conference finals. This is one of those years where you're just like, it's inexcusable. It's inexplicable. And so I think it was just time.
Yeah. So you touched on a lot of my big concerns with Doc from a Sixers perspective, but I think let's start with the positives with him. And I think, you know, specifically his handling of the Sterling situation. And as you said, I mean, he just has the reputation of being like a genuinely good guy. Having to deal with the Sterling situation gives him experience with tumultuous ownership and front office, so that will help him, I would say, joining the Sixers. And of course, you know, his experience the big three Celtics, the Lob City Clippers, and now Paul George and Kawhi. He's coached superstars before, so he's got the ego management part on his resume. So how do you see him fitting in Philly with, you know, Ben Simmons, Joel Embiid, Al Horford, Tobias Harris, Josh Richardson, assuming all of those guys come back next year?
I for one feel like the Sixers need to make a move. I don't know if, you know, I'm not really in on the Sixers, so I don't know where they stand on this, but something just didn't stand right during the season. Something just didn't sit right, and I don't know what happened there. Maybe the Horford move just didn't work as Elton Brand in the front office expected. But look, I think it's important and good, actually, that the best players are clearly starting players, because I think the only guys you can argue that should be playing, you know, heavy minutes are Ben, Joel, Tobias, and Al Horford and Josh Richardson. So outside of those, like, you know, with the Clippers situation, you had two of the best scorers in the league coming off the bench, and I think you had to find minutes for them. I don't see a situation like that happening with the Sixers, and I think with a more balanced attack, Doc can be good with a team that has a balanced attack. I think the bench guys really just gave him trouble, and we forget that Tobias Harris had his best season mm-hmm. of his career under Doc Rivers here with the Clippers. They built a system around him. You know, he averaged 20 plus the first month and a half of the season, and led the Clippers to the first overall seed in the West that last year. So I'll be interested to see how everything fits together. It's tough to know off the bat because I feel like they still need to get some shooters, obviously. I think that team definitely lacks shooting. But Doc is a guy who I think Joel Embiid, for example, I think is a guy who many have questioned his, you know, desire to play or effort, I would say. Mm-hmm. And so I think Doc is the guy who really gets guys to buy in. You know, when Lou Williams came to the Clippers, there were reports that he just wanted to retire. He was traded twice in about 5 months. L.A. to Houston to L.A., and he was just ready to call it because that's not what he wanted. Harrell hadn't played much at all. And so the one thing Rivers is good at, which I really admire, is that he really gets guys to buy in to a system and a culture, and I think that's sort of what the Sixers are missing. Mm-hmm. I don't think they have an identity. They have a lot of really good players, but they don't have a real system or culture identity in place. Right. And I think Doc Rivers will help instill that. Obviously, they gave him the 5-year deal, so they believe that this is going to be a long term process. You know, I think you can say they're in win now mode, but again, this won't happen overnight for them. But yeah, I think the biggest thing that Doc brings is he'll be able to bring a culture and identity and help guys buy in to the point where, you know, hopefully you don't have to question the effort of Joel Embiid. Hopefully you don't have to question why Ben Simmons makes certain moves or doesn't shoot the ball here or there, or you have to question Al Horford's fit, you know, assuming everyone stays in place and they decide to run it back. Right. Me personally, I think they do have enough to run it back. I don't necessarily think they need to make that many changes, just a few minor adjustments in the roster. But yeah, I'd just be interested to see the style that Rivers implements in this with this team, because this team is talented. It's very talented. I think a lot of people penciled them in as you know, conference finals team. Obviously Ben went down, but I think, you know, no one had them getting swept mm-hmm. by the Celtics. And so yeah, I think there's a lot of work to be done there, but I think Doc Rivers is the right guy for that job. Like I said, I think what really hampered him here in LA is that there were other guys. There were so many mouths to feed. You know, you forget, I didn't mention this earlier, but, you know, to Rivers' credit, you know, he's obviously a player's coach, and Harrell is coming off. He's in a contract year. He's playing for arguably the biggest contract of his career right here. And so you can't simply bench a guy like that. And I think he had just so many moving parts and things to consider that it ended up just being a lot here in LA. And so I think once you go back, once he's here in Philly, it's a lot more of a smoother operation. It's not that hard. You know who your key cogs are. You know who you have to go to. So I look forward to seeing how that works out. I I can't imagine it going badly, honestly, because Doc Rivers is just a fantastic leader. He's a great motivator and a guy who, like I said earlier, just instills a culture in that's hard to not buy into. Mm-hmm. And so I really look forward to seeing what he does with that Sixers team, what he does with Joel and Ben, and Tobias even, because Tobias just had a horrid, horrid year. I don't think anyone expected that from him. So I really look forward to seeing what he does with that team, and especially with Tobias.
Yeah, and Woj specifically mentioned Tobias in his report, saying, you know, that was one of the things that really drew the Sixers to Doc. As you mentioned, you know, he did get the career year out of Tobias in LA, and that's what caused the Sixers to trade for him and then pay him an enormous sum of money. So now they, you know, they need to get a better return on that investment, because it's going to be really hard. I mean, you know, Elton Brand has come out and said he doesn't want to trade Ben or Joel this offseason. If they're going to try to trade one of Tobias or Al Horford, it's going to be really hard. Those guys are on bad contracts. And now I would think with Doc coming in, Tobias is probably off the table for trades as well this offseason. But I'm glad you brought up the culture, because, you know, that was one of the things that Josh Richardson said was missing from this year's team, was just a sense of accountability. And he didn't name names when he said that, but, you know, you can probably assume it was some veiled reference to Embiid's conditioning, Ben Simmons being unwilling to shoot threes, you know, especially after Brett Brown like comes out and pleads with him in the public to like take 1-3 a game, and he doesn't do it for 25 games after that. So do you think, like, Doc, can he be the guy to establish that sense of accountability? And, you know, you said he's great at getting guys to buy in, which is awesome. But, you know, given his reputation as a player's coach, and we had Yaron Weitzman on back in March, who just wrote the book on the Sixers, and it sounds like one of the big problems with the organization is they've kind of catered to Ben and Joel, like, almost too much, you know. So can Rivers toe the line between player's coach, but also hold these guys accountable and, like, force them to get better?
I think that's the biggest question. You know, going into this series, I think you would hope that he could. But a lot of the issues that the Clippers had this year, chemistry-wise, I think were because Paul George and Kawhi may have had some, you know, preferential treatment here and there, and, you know, weren't exactly held accountable, I would say. But I will say that this situation is a little different. You know, Kawhi signed here, and the pressure to win was felt almost instantly. You know, once they traded their five or six picks for Paul George, along with Shea, who was supposed to be a franchise cornerstone, was literally untouchable until Kawhi asked for PG. You know, I think the pressure was on. And so I think I don't want to say Kawhi ran the franchise, because that's not what happened. But it was hard to go against a lot of what Kawhi wanted, I'll say that. Here with the Clippers. So I think now that Doc Rivers is in Philadelphia, he's got a lot more control. I'd say he's probably going to have the team that he wants. I don't think he got a role in the front office, but he'll have a say, obviously. Ultimately, it does come down to Ben and Joel committing and doing what's being asked of them. You know, it's tough to say bench a guy like Joel or Ben if they don't do what Doc asks, you know. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, it does come down to them. You know, Joel's effort, Ben's, you know, getting better, consistently getting better, keeping to work on his game, and going from there. I don't know how much Doc can do a lot for this team in terms of the culture, like I said. But ultimately, I think it comes down to your stars. I mean, they get it done on the court. You know, to Doc's credit, he didn't blow three straight 16-point leads in the playoffs in the last series. You know, they were able to build a 16-point lead, but hey, the players are the guys on the court who gave up that lead. Even when Zubats came back in, the Clippers were giving up leads. That's not entirely on Doc. Mm-hmm. You know, he can make adjustments here and there, but that's on the players. So I don't think Doc to take all of the blame for that. However, You know, a lot of it was on him. So I think Doc just also needed a new place just to move on. Like I said earlier, there's just a lot of. I mean, I will say Philly is obviously a big sports town, a very critical sports town, and they'll get on you if you lose. But LA, I think LA was also just a bit wearing down on Doc. I'll say that. And so I think if Doc can get these guys to buy in, even if we see signs of it happening slowly, because we know this won't happen overnight. Mm-hmm. But if we see it's happening slowly throughout the season, I think that'll be good for them. It's ultimately down to the players, though. You know, Joel can be a 30-15 guy every single night and dominate, but he just has to want it. I feel like he hasn't wanted it. This is my outside perspective because I don't cover the team. I don't watch the Sixers as much. It just looked like he hasn't wanted it as much. And I really think he could be the best big man in the NBA, no questions asked. Mm-hmm. He just has to want it. Ben can be, you know, the best point forward to ever play. I mean, his size and speed are incredible for a guy 6'9". That combination is lethal. And so I think Doc will – I think Doc's going to have a good time, like an enjoyable time figuring out this puzzle, figuring out how everyone works together here, because you have a guy in Ben who needs the ball, a guy who in Joel who needs the ball, Tobias, who also sort of needs the ball, and you know his game is centered a lot around the mid range and the mid post area. So it'll be interesting. There's a lot of moving pieces to this. I'll be curious to see. And then we haven't even mentioned Al Horford, who yeah. I'm curious how he fits into this all. So for me personally, it's hard to predict what ends up happening or how Doc does with this team. I think he'll do well. I don't envision it going badly. Mm-hmm. Just because he's a good leader. He's had, I believe it's 13 straight winning seasons, if I'm not mistaken. Dating back to the Celtics here. So he's not going to be on losing teams. He's a good coach. He's a great coach. So, I have a hard time seeing how this will work. But I think it'll go well. I don't see any reason why it'll go badly. But like I said, I think they need a couple extra pieces, like a shooter here and there, maybe a better wing defender. Maybe Matisse can be that guy on both ends. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we just got to see what happens.
Yeah, I'm not sure if anyone's going to move. I'm going to guess it would be Al Horford. You know, that one of the popular trade ideas on Sixers Twitter is some combination of Al Horford for Buddy Hield, which I still don't understand why the Kings do it, but I guess we'll find out in a few months. But
we don't know why the Kings do anything.
Right. There is that. but I mean, do you think, given the options that were on the market, the Sixers were very clearly after both Ty Lue and Mike D'Antoni as well. Do you think Doc was the best option for them?
Oh, absolutely. I thought as soon as Doc was released, that's the number one free agent coach on the market, mm-hmm. Without a doubt. I mean, don't let his shortcomings with the Clippers distract you from the fact that he's a great coach. He's a championship-winning coach. He's been to a couple conference finals as well. So I thought once he was released, he should have instantly been every single team's top option. And I also, maybe it's just me, and maybe you can speak to this, but I didn't understand the Mike D'Antoni fit so much. Mm-hmm. I know the Sixers wanted a better offensive system in place, but Joel just didn't seem like a D'Antoni guy. Neither did Horford, really. So I don't know where that fit was, which is why I thought as soon as Doc was available, I thought Philly should probably jump on this. And they did. They didn't wait very long. I mean, he was signed within 72 hours. He was on a plane to Philly within 24. So it's no surprise. As soon as I saw that he was going to on his way to Philly to watch the game, I was like, yeah, this is probably – they shouldn't let him leave without a signature in place because I don't see a better coach out there.
Yeah,
especially with the Clippers seemingly locked in on Tyronn Lue for now. Maybe the Pelicans have a chance at him right now. I just didn't see any reason that the Sixers should mess around. Just sign Doc Rivers and get this started.
Yeah. Yeah, it felt like he was – I'm with you on the D'Antoni thing, and Morton and I talked about that when those rumors really percolated, especially with the whole, like, they're going to hire him to get James Harden in 2 years. Which was just absolute.
That was, I got Knicks vibe from that. Like, yeah. Knicks fans, hopeful vibes.
I just so did I. That. Yeah. but yeah, I mean, I think, you know, championship experience, experience managing a bunch of different players and kind of molding his system based on the talent he has, I think we're all big selling points for Doc. I think you're right. It comes down to Ben and Joe and just kind of ego management at large. Like if the same pitfalls that, you know, kind of led to the downfall of Lob City, and then also whatever happened in the locker room this year with the Clippers, that very well could rear its head in Philly too. And then I think you probably end up getting to a point where you have to choose between Ben or Joel, but I think they're going to try to give this thing a shot with both of them at first and see if he can, you know, take it, maximize, or continue building upon the foundation that Brett Brown laid over the years.
So ultimately, I mean, look, again, I'm not with the Sixers. I have no idea, but I've spoken to a trainer who's told me that Ben and Joel don't like each other.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's true, but I think that's where, you know, that's what I thought about when they hired Doc. I'm like, Doc is a guy who brings guys together. I think this Clipper situation for this past year is a very unique situation, considering Trez's free agency, you know, Lou being the sixth man of the year back-to-back years, Kawhi and PG, Pat Bev, those guys coming off a great year with the Clippers last year. There was just a lot really involved there. It was tough. I really look forward to seeing what Doc does with Joel and Ben. Because I really think those two should find a way on the court and to get along, to play well. I don't think there's a reason they shouldn't. Those two they should be, in my opinion, probably a top five duo in the NBA. And I just don't feel like they play like it on a night-to-night basis. Maybe you can speak more to that, but that's just how I feel. I think Doc Rivers can really help those two there, really building a chemistry a bond between them on the court, you know, a 1-2 punch, really.
Mm-hmm. All right, Mort, we are done with Sixers Hour, so I will defer to you in terms of asking about, you know, what's next for kind of the other openings around the league, specifically, you know, Clippers and Indiana.
Oh, so, well, in terms of the Clippers, it makes sense to go for Ty Lue, but right now he's apparently interviewing with the Pelicans, so we'll see what kind of happens there. I think he's probably the biggest domino left, right? I mean, you could argue Mike D'Antoni, but given age, given, you know, that most of the teams with available coaching slots don't really have rosters that are necessarily optimized to the way that he uses them, I think Lou might be the big get. And you know, Tomer, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but I read right after Doc's dismissal that Lou was apparently, you know, the front runner for the Clippers spot, but he was kind of hesitating because he's so fiercely loyal to Doc that he actually didn't want to step on any toes to take that job. Is that correct?
I don't know if that's correct specifically. I know that, you know, as soon as they released Doc or announced a mutual parting of ways, Lou was the first name that came up, and it's still one of the biggest names that comes up, along with Jeff Van Gundy. I think the Clippers want an outside hire. You know, while their interest in Lou is serious and he is a strong candidate, you know, I guess the concern is, does he have Doc Rivers-like philosophies? Because if he does, what are you really changing head coaching-wise? Obviously, you're just changing a name, but are you doing it just to change names? I think because there was such a difference in philosophical ideas and the way to run the team, I don't think you want to bring back a guy who's going to run things the exact way Doc was going to run him. Now, that's not to say that Lou would have done that, because I think he did a fantastic job with the Cavs. He held guys accountable. We all read the stories about him yelling at LeBron at halftime, telling him, hey, we need you to do more. So it's not like he doesn't hold guys accountable, and that's one of the things that I like about him. I think that's an important for a team like this, where guys need to be held accountable. There can't really be preferential treatment on a team like this. Everyone needs to be held accountable for their own mistakes, you know, on both ends. And so, yeah, if Lou isn't the guy for the Clippers, which I think is very much a possibility, that I envision him going to New Orleans, I don't see why. Yeah. He wouldn't go to New Orleans. David Griffin is there. He won a title with Lou. It just makes all the sense in the world to me. Now, they're not in a championship situation, so I don't know how much that interests Lou. But I do know that in the past he's wanted to coach sort of a team of his own, a young team of his own, and sort of help build their identity based off him, his sort of fighting mentality. I think he wants to instill that identity in the team. I think if he ends up going to New Orleans, you know, obviously Mike D'Antoni is sort of the odd man out. And I think he probably ends up going to Indiana. That's my guess. I don't know this for a fact. But I think that was the talk before the Sixers keyed in on him, of D'Antoni possibly going to Indiana. And Indiana has a lot of offensive weapons. And I think D'Antoni can probably find a way to utilize all of them to the best of their abilities. They got two big men in Turner and Sabonis who can shoot the ball, who can rebound the ball. And I think, you know, not to discredit Nate McMillan because he's a great coach. I didn't think he deserved to be fired. But D'Antoni's system would probably make that Indiana Pacers offense look a lot better. I know McMillan was more of a defensive coach, but D'Antoni would make that offense look a lot better. And so, yeah, I don't know where the Clippers go from there. If Lou goes to New Orleans and D'Antoni goes to Indiana, I threw around D'Antoni to the Clippers as a joke, just because that'd be kind of a wild scenario to see D'Antoni coach this team. But yeah, I think there's a chance the Clippers just go outside hire completely out of left field in terms of hiring a new candidate. I think Woj reported this, but I've heard as well that the Clippers might want just new blood, someone right. who hasn't coached in the NBA yet, but someone who could, you know, put his stamp down, lay his identity down with this team, and go from there. That's kind of a risky move, considering you're in the final year of Kawhi and PG's deals, and if last year wasn't a win now year. I mean, this is the absolute win now. You have to win, and you have to at least get to the NBA Finals, if you ask me. I think if you get to the NBA Finals, you put yourself in good position to win. And if you don't, you can say, okay, we were close, we can run it back. But if you don't make the NBA Finals in a year that Kawhi and PG are free agents, it's tough. It's tough. I don't envision them going anywhere, but I don't think you want to give them any reason to go anywhere. And so that starts with coaching. We'll see who... Steve Ballmer and Jerry West in the front office pick. They'll probably talk to Kawhi and PG and some of the guys about it, you know, to get their blessings, obviously. But, yeah, I'll be interested to see who they pick because, yeah, they very well could go the new blood, you know, coach-wise and just go with someone out of left field that we didn't really see coming. You know, I know that Greg Popovich recently sold his house. I know it's wild to even envision that. But, man, if the Clippers could somehow land Greg Popovich, I mean, reunite him with Kawhi, that would be – again, this is wild, obviously, but that would be incredible. That would be incredible.
Man, I mean, okay, I see, that's an interesting name being brought up. That's definitely out of left field. I'll give you that one. But in terms of, like, fresh blood, like, do you think they could go into, like, the college ranks?
I think it's possible. I mean – you know, we saw the OKC Thunder in KD's final year.
Yeah.
Go with Fred Hoiberg out of, I believe, it's Florida, right?
Fred Hoiberg was from Iowa State.
Billy Donovan. Okay. Sorry,
yeah,
Billy Donovan. My bad. I'm confusing the Bulls coaches. My bad. There you go.
Yeah.
But yeah, they went Billy Donovan out of Florida, and I could see the Clippers doing that. I don't think it'll be completely shocking. I don't know who there wants to coach in the NBA. I don't know if Jay Wright has been in the NBA. Maybe a Coach K, Coach Cal. There's so many options there. I don't know where you start. But I think to answer your question, yes, I think it's possible they go to the coaching ranks and try to find sort of a young, fresh blood, first-year coach, you know, a la Steve Kerr, with the Warriors in 2015, right. Tyronn Lue in 2016, Nick Nurse in 2019, mm-hmm. Just something like that, something along those lines. I wouldn't be surprised if they did that because Ballmer is a guy who always, to me anyways, thinks outside the box. And we've seen Jerry West and what the kind of impact that he has. You know, he turned the Lakers into a championship organization with Shaq and Kobe. Obviously, they won championships before, but you know what I mean. And then he did that with the Warriors as well. Right. So You know, I think there's a time window that West works in. It's like a 4 to 5 year window where he turns a team into a championship contender. And I think this is that fourth or fifth year coming up. And I think it's about time. I think West really makes that impact, if that makes sense. You know, this is the year where he's got to sort of break through and get that title. So I think they'll have a big decision to make coaching wise. And really, I don't think it'll be surprising if they go, you know, something out of left field, something we don't see coming, whether it's coaching wise, whether it's Popovich wise, I don't know. But yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah.
I do agree with you on the D'Antoni to Indiana. That's come up before. We had Caitlin Cooper on the podcast some weeks ago, and I think we talked about that scenario. And there's definitely some intrigue there. I agree that there are some components in Indiana that would definitely be enhanced with the presence of D'Antoni. Like Malcolm Brogdon would probably be an instant all-star, right? But I wonder if, given the whole strategy change in Houston with no bigs and whatnot, which was, you know, one thing was that it was Dale Morey's baby, but you know, it was just as much a D'Antoni decision. Like those two were on the same page with that. So I wonder if D'Antoni, if he's, you know, obviously he's looking for a new gig, if he has this demand of, you know what, if I'm coming to you guys, I don't want a big clunking center. I don't want, you know, a team that's loaded up with big players. I want flexibility on the perimeter. I want lots of three-point shooting. In which case, you know, if you're the Clippers and you, Montrezl Harrell is a free agent and Zubac is your remaining big guy who doesn't demand a big role, you know, everything can run through Kawhi and Paul George and Lou, you know, that has to be a very attractive spot for him. So and then again, you know, you brought it up in terms of giving, you know, Kawhi and Paul George giving the Clippers their blessings on a coach. You know, those two guys might also just say, hey, you know what, we want a known commodity. Maybe that's just what we want going into next year. We don't want to, you know, find ourselves on the losing end one more time. Like next year, it's all or nothing. It's all in, and we need someone with a proven track record. So maybe that plays in as well.
The one thing I will say to D'Antoni's credit is I think he was working with an owner who didn't really want him there, and an owner who wasn't willing to spend. And so I think they signed Capella to that extension before Fertitta got there. I don't know if that's true, but I think they did. And so I think to maximize Russell Westbrook, it was a move I don't think they had to make, but to maximize Westbrook, you probably should have done that. Yeah. So I don't even know if that's a move he wanted to make. I think with the small ball running gun style, I think you need a big man who can at least defend the rim. Yeah. You know, we saw him be able to do that with the Suns. I think Amari sort of played that role. Obviously small ball, but he could defend the rim at times. You know, with the Knicks, I think he had Tyson Chandler. Obviously that didn't work out well, but I just feel like you need that big. And I don't think D'Antoni would be completely opposed to having that big man there. This is why I like Indiana for him, because Miles Turner can really spread the floor out, but he can also really block shots and just change shots around the rim for you. Sabonis can create, Oladipo can create, Brogdon can turn into an all-star under him. They have a lot of moving pieces there that you know, with the right coach, should be able to be a high-powered offense, in my opinion. Indiana underwhelmed for me this year. TJ Warren, we saw. Bubble Warren was insane. So I thought, you know, I really thought they could take the next step, and I think D'Antoni helps them do that, in my opinion. I don't think he deserves a lot of the blame with Houston. I just think they went up against the LeBron and AD team that was, you know, too good, two of the top five players in the league. You weren't going to stop that, especially at their size and where the Rockets didn't have size. You know, they went up against the Warriors with KD. You know, arguably they should have won last year when KD went down. But the year before that, I mean, if CP doesn't go down, you can make the case they're in the NBA Finals and possibly NBA champions. It's a CP hamstring pull away. So I don't fault D'Antoni too much there. I don't think Fertitta did as much as he possibly could to build the best team for D'Antoni. You know, obviously Morey's the one making the moves, but Fertitta's the one that signs off. So I really like D'Antoni with with the Pacers. I think he helps them a lot. The only question is who does that leave for the Clippers? Like I said, you know, I think they'll go fresh blood, but right now, you know, if Lou ends up signing with the New Orleans Pelicans, I don't think there's a coach linked to them publicly, anyways. Maybe Van Gundy, but I don't know how high they are on that hire.
Oh, like, yeah, I don't think they should.
Can you explain, like,
yeah, I don't think so either.
Why is he being mentioned in conjunction with this? Like, he was one of the top two candidates named right away.
I mean, it seems like every time there's a coach opening, both Mark Jackson and Jeff Van Gundy's names are sort of floated around.
Yeah.
I think if you looked at the betting odds, I think it was I think Lou was first. I think that Chauncey Billups was third, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so betting odds, obviously, you're not taking betting odds for their word. But they had, you know, Lou first, Van Gundy second, Chauncey Billups third, and Mark Jackson fourth. Mike D'Antoni's actually fifth for that. I don't know why he got named there. You know, Van Gundy hasn't coached since, I think, 2007 with the Rockets. I don't know what's changed. Maybe they like his personality, and they think the team will you know, reflect off that, but I honestly can't put my finger on why they think Jeff Van Gundy is. And that's not to discredit him. I don't know if he's a good coach or not. I really don't. I just don't see why that is one of the top two names thrown out there. And honestly, maybe it's sort of a smokescreen type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
The Clippers have sort of worked in silence over the last couple of years when it comes to every move, and so it could just be sort of a smokescreen to throw other people off. And then all of a sudden we're going to get that brand new hire out of left field that we all didn't expect. I mean, some of us expect, but I really can't pinpoint why he's, you know, a top two candidate, at least publicly.
Well, right. I look forward to Mark Jackson taking the sidelines of the LA Clippers.
Oh.
Oh my goodness.
I
don't even know. I don't want to imagine that. I'll just say that.
I find it interesting, you know, your take on the Lou situation, because, you know, I was kind of wondering whether, you know, Lou interviewed with the Sixers on Tuesday, I believe, or at least he was scheduled to interview with them on Tuesday, and then he was also linked to this New Orleans job. So I kind of wondered if, you know, their timing with Doc was because they saw, oh, we actually might want Ty Lue to replace him, and we might lose him to one of these other teams, so we need to either act with Doc now, or we're going to be stuck with him next year.
In terms of the Clippers' timing?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I don't really think it had anything to do with that. Honestly, I know personally that Doc and Steve Ballmer met, I think it was over four or five times since the Clippers got eliminated. Well, at least they spoke on the phone. They had conversations.
Mm-hmm.
And so this wasn't like, you know, an overnight decision that Obama was like, all right, we got to move on.
Mm-hmm.
This is something they talked about for a couple of days. And I think, look, this is me personally. I don't know this for a fact. This is just my guess. But I think the Nuggets, like I said earlier, being handled by the Lakers so easily, and that's probably what the Clippers should have done. I think that was final. That was like the final straw for Ballmer.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just that they blew a 3-1 lead, but it was the process in blowing a 3-1 lead, in not having a complete offensive system in place, and playing Trez way too many minutes, not trusting Zubats. You know, I think that is ultimately why and when the Clippers and Doc parted ways. I don't really think it had much to do with coaching availability and who was out there. That's just me. Maybe I'm wrong about that. But the sense I get is that, you know, we saw Chris Haynes report that Doc Rivers was expected to stay as soon as the Clippers were eliminated. But to me, that felt like way too quick an announcement, considering you hadn't really had a chance to sit down, evaluate the season as a whole, the playoffs as a whole, see what happened there. So I think once Ballmer, Jerry West, Lawrence Frank, the front office, sat down, you know, talked to the players and sat down and talked about it, I think they came to the decision that it was ultimately just time to move on.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that, Ballmer, part of Ballmer wanted Doc to stay, but I think that Doc mentioned something like, I think it was in the ESPN article, that Doc was unwilling to coach without Ballmer's full support. It just didn't feel right. So he felt like it was time for both to just move on. And so, yeah, I just don't think it had too much to do with who was available and just them taking their time to evaluate the season, where they went wrong, and sort of go from there.
Yeah, that all makes sense. Well, we appreciate your insight on all of this coaching carousel that is still not anywhere near settled. But, you know, now I think we have to wrap up by talking about the NBA Finals, although I don't know how much there is to say, unfortunately. Goran Dragic, Bam Adebayo, both doubtful for Game 2. Dragic suffered a plantar fascia tear in his left foot. Bam hurt his shoulder. So, I mean, it seems like both guys are going to be out tonight. The Lakers just absolutely manhandled the Heat. You know, the Heat got off to a great start. I think they were up 23-10 in the first quarter, and then... Yeah. You know, Dragic went out, I think, in the second quarter. Bam left, I want to say, in the third quarter. And it was just all Lakers from there. So, Tomer, is there anything we could do to prevent LeBron James and the Lakers from winning this title? Like, or is it just, is this thing over?
I'm actually not as I guess, pessimistic as you guys are, or you are, Brian.
Oh, okay.
You know, the Heat, I think, went up 25-12, and they gave up a 75-30 run after that. Mm-hmm. That is just not going to happen in the NBA. You know, the Lakers, I think their final numbers showed they shot under 40% from three, but I think for most of the game, they're around 46, 47%. I think what killed the Heat is that end of the second quarter stretch where they decided to just play completely small and Anthony Davis killed them. He scored, I think, around 6 or 7, maybe 8 points to close out that quarter and got the Lakers back in that game. And then from there on, they just manhandled him. I don't see that happening again. I mean, Miami and Eric Spoelstra, led by Eric Spoelstra, they're a tough-minded team. I think they know this is really just one game. While I think they know they're underdogs and they don't have a great chance to win, especially without Dragic and without Bam. I feel like they know that they can win some games here. You know, Myers Leonard might have to be activated now. We could see more Kelly Olynyk minutes. I don't know who else they really have at the big man position outside of those two, which concerns me. But you know, when I previewed this matchup on my podcast last week, I said, and this is not a hot take, everyone knows this, but I said you really should just make LeBron James a scorer and not let him get everyone else involved. Now, that's way easier said than done because LeBron loves to get the guys involved. So don't get me wrong. It's not easy to do. But I think that if you make LeBron a scorer, you're really just not letting Danny Green kill you with three threes. You're not letting KCP go off. You're not letting Markieff Morris hit a couple threes. Those are the backbreakers where the Lakers move the ball around and they got guys like Rondo hitting a three, Quinn Cook hitting a three, Kuzma hitting a three, Morris hitting a three. I mean, they had, what, 10 players hit a three last game? Mm-hmm. It's just wild. And everyone got involved for them. So, you know, I don't envision Tyler Hero having a 6-for-18 performance again. You know, I think he was a team worst minus 30 in the first half.
Yeah,
which is it's crazy. I just don't see that happening again. You know, Butler obviously isn't 100%, but I think he has a better game. Duncan Robinson won't be 0-for-3 again. I think the Lakers did a great job, you know, studying the scouting report and knowing the spots that Duncan Robinson likes to get to and how he likes to get his shots off. I'm not as pessimistic as you may be. That's not to say I'm hopeful. You know, I'm hopeful the Heat win a game, but I think they can make this competitive. You know, the Lakers shot really well for most of that game before the Heat made their minor comeback to make it seem more of a close game. But maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. I just don't see the Heat getting completely dominated like this again. I just don't think Spoelstra, Butler, that's not their mentality. That's not how they do things. They're going to fight. They're going to fight till the end. And so I expect, you know, if Bam, before we knew about the injuries, I expected Goran to play, Bam to play. And I thought the Heat would win game two.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not as not as optimistic about them winning game two now. But I think that if you give Bam and Dragic a day off, hopefully maybe they can, you know, I think there was talks of Dragic getting an injection and Bam maybe being able to go for game three. Maybe you just you know, lay it out on the line for game three and try to pull off a game there. But yeah, I think the Heat should put up a good fight. I don't think this will just be another runaway blowout win for the Lakers. I think the Heat put up a fight, and if they lose, they're going to go down fighting. I'll say that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for sure. And, I mean, Kendrick Nunn did come in, and I think he put up 18 points, I want to say, off the bench in Dragic's absence. So they do have depth, and that was one of the big selling points for the Heat going into the series. But more, you know, assuming Bam is out for game two, who do you start in his place if you're the Heat, knowing you've got to deal with AD and Dwight in that opposing starting lineup?
Well, if I'm Bill Simmons, I apparently start Udonis Haslem with the entire mindset of basically hacking their heads off the Lakers, which is one of the worst ideas I've ever heard. But it's
six fouls, baby.
Did you say that?
Oh, did you say that? Yeah, yeah. There was a podcast, and they were like, "That's a great idea. Let's just get Udonis Haslem in there and spend his six fouls on hacking people." It was just
he said that. Oh my god!
But I mean, look, Bill Simmons has become like one of the biggest trolls now. He's just taken over after Skip Bayless
bounced. Yes, clearly.
But I have a fun idea. Let me put it that way. I have no idea if it's gonna work, but it would be a completely different look. Derek Jones Jr. at center. Just run all day long as much as you can. I don't think it's necessarily going to work, but I would love to see it, because otherwise it's like Kelly Olynyk, and he's not really going to provide you with the athleticism and the speed. His jumper is just not as reliable as you want it to be. Now, he can mimic some of the playmaking because he's a really good passer, so that's part of it, though. But at the end of the day, I think you need to outrun the Lakers to stand a chance, and why not go with Derek Jones Jr. at the five? If that's the case,
yeah. And I mean, sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. No, I was just gonna say, if we watch the end of that first quarter, AD tore them up when they went small.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If you watch what the Rockets did, they tried to go small ball on the Rockets, and the Lakers just adjusted. Took out their center, made AD the five, and killed him from there. I think it's worth looking into. I'll say that, but I think you got to go with the traditional big man there. Maybe for me personally, I think you try to throw Myers Leonard out there. I don't know if he's injured. I don't know why he hasn't played, but I think you could try and throw him out there, a floor spacing big man. Try to pull AD out of the painted area if possible. They might just throw JaVale or Dwight or something on him. But just try to open up the floor more with Myers Leonard out there, and see if that works. I don't know if that'll work for them. But then again, they're kind of down to two big options.
Mm-hmm.
So at this point, you got to just try whatever's on the table. You got to try it and see if it works. Because I kind of like Derek Jones Jr. as that off the bench sort of energy boost for the Heat. I don't know if you can replicate that A, with him starting, and then B, for the bench, who is that guy now? So while I do think he could provide some energy for them, I think it's best if he does that off the bench. That's just me, though. Olynyk is a decent player, but he'll probably get eaten up inside. He's not that same physical guy that AD is or Dwight is. So I don't know if you can really go with him. That's why I think Leonard could probably hold his own.
The problem with Leonard,
when it comes down to
the problem with Leonard, and this is kind of crucial, is he's played 9 minutes in the playoffs. He's played one game and only 9 minutes. So I wonder if the conditioning level is even there, or if the rust is just so significant that he's just unplayable. I have no idea.
I mean, this is the definition. This is why coaches say you got to stay ready. If they do call him, we'll see if he's been ready. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah, I mean, these injuries just suck, because it really removes a lot of the fun chess matches that we were expecting going into the series. You know, Bam and AD in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I mean, that was the series. Like, Bam was so important to what they need to do defensively against this big Lakers team that, you know, God forbid if he got hurt, and unfortunately he did. It's just, I mean, as you guys are going through here, it's like talking yourself into one of Kelly Olynyk, Myers Leonard, Derrick Jones Jr. It's like, these are the best of a bunch of bad options, and I don't know that any of them are necessarily going to work. So, I mean, Tomer, I'm with you. I don't necessarily think they're going to get blown out by 30. I think they are going to, you know, everyone's going to know that they have to pick up more of the slack with these two important options out. And more, I mean, maybe your idea to start Derrick Jones, just like, it might bait the Lakers into just saying, okay, we're going to assert our will down low. And, you know, you kind of goad them into more posting up and fewer threes, which, you know, at a certain point, you just hope the math wins out there. But yeah, I mean, you know, if the Lakers supporting cast plays as well as they did in game one, that was going into the series, you figured Miami supporting cast is going to outplay the Lakers supporting cast, but LeBron and AD are just so dominant that you just need to, you know, you really need to blow them out, not counting the stars. You know, they didn't do that in game one. So if the Lakers supporting cast continues to play this well, we're probably looking at a sweep or five games. But yeah, I mean, if Miami's can figure out some way to stem the bleeding without Dragic and Bam, who I'd argue are two of their three most important players, you could get Spo's Hall of Fame placard ready if he somehow comes back and wins this series.
I mean, it's not, again, I think when it came, a lot of points were scored in garbage time. Mm-hmm. But looking at it now, I mean, the Heat's second unit and other guys did outscore the Lakers' other guys. It was just LeBron and AD asserting their dominance in the first 36 minutes of the game, where it was pretty much over. And then Bam finishing with 8 points, Dragic had 6 points, Robinson didn't score. Those are the guys that they usually get lifts from. Mm-hmm. And so I think other guys had to score. Like, look, I personally, I think game two and possibly game three are the Duncan Robinson, Tyler Hero games. Those are the two games I think those two have to step up and really show up to this game. Like, they have to combine for 40, I think, mm-hmm. between them, if they want to stand a chance. Because otherwise, I just don't see how the Heat win a game without those two really stepping up. And Tyler Hero can't shoot 6 for 18.
Right.
You just can't do that. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. I mean, Kendrick Nunn, we'll see if he shows up. I really want to see Iguodala on LeBron more. I don't know if he still has it, but he's played LeBron well in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm curious to see if he takes that challenge on. I know the Lakers run a lot of switches sometimes and go to AD sometimes, so it'll be interesting to see. I like you said, there's not a lot of good options for them at center right now, but you gotta make do with what you got.
There is one option that we haven't talked about, and he hasn't played in the entire playoffs. In fact, he hasn't played in a month and a half, in part because of a leg pubic bone. But Chris Silva could be an interesting option when you really think about it, if he's healthy. You know, he's a strong shot blocker, he's a strong rebounder, he's got this strong baseline. He's kind of like a Taj Gibson light. So he's got the length, he's got the athleticism, he's got strength. I wonder if the Heat dust him off and see what's there. Also, just to give the Lakers a look that they have not prepared for whatsoever.
I mean, I honestly didn't know he was in the bubble with them. And that's at this point, you might as well just try whatever.
Yeah.
But with what is he, a second year guy? Third year guy?
This is his first year.
He can't be. Oh, he's a rookie. Okay. I mean, look, throwing a rookie against LeBron and AD and telling him to try and hold his own is no easy task. I mean, that's not an easy task for a veteran. No.
Welcome to your playoff debut. Game two of the NBA Finals.
NBA Finals. Yeah, not easy. But like we said, they're out of options. I just see now the Lakers are favored by 9.5 points for game two with Dragic and Adebayo doubtful.
If Chris Silva starts tonight, I want partial credit for that.
that's fair.
Should give you credit post game press conference.
Yeah, he's listening to this podcast. This is pregame prep. Tomer, what was your pick going into this series? And then how does it, I mean, like, I picked Heat in six before, and I'm just ready to throw that out right now.
I had Lakers in six, mainly because I thought the Heat would figure out a way to score the ball and really get a bad LeBron scoring game. I also think what hasn't been talked about, sorry to just go off topic a bit, but yeah. Anthony Davis from mid-range has been, yeah. I thought he would come back down to earth, but he simply has remained an absolute torch from the mid-range area.
Yeah.
It's incredible. You know, I thought after the Houston series he'd come back down to earth, but he has just been lighting it up. And so I think it's kind of hard to imagine him having a bad shooting game now, because he's just, you know, if he's not making shots, he's going to the line. And so I thought that you could probably get away with a couple wins for Miami with LeBron bad scoring games, bad shooting games. Maybe shoots like, you know, maybe a 6-for-18 game or something along those lines, mm-hmm. And sneak out a win. You know, out of Duncan Robinson gets hot, Tyler Hero gets hot, one of those guys. And I thought they'd sneak out a couple wins, but now, I mean, the Heat would probably be lucky to win one game.
Yeah.
This is assuming that Dragic does not come back for the series, because even if he does, he's probably playing at, what, 60%, if that?
Mm-hmm.
Bam Adebayo, he'll probably come back in the series at some point. But, I mean, without him, you're really struggling. I mean, without Dragic, you can live with, I think. You can work around that. Without Adebayo, one of your primary, you know, playmakers and scorers, I mean, it's just tough to work around.
Yeah.
So, you know, now I probably have I'll still give the Heat a game. I'll say Lakers in five. Gentlemen sweep. They'll be polite to them. They'll give them a game. But it's just tough to envision a path to Miami winning more than one game right now, yeah. Unfortunately. Yeah. At full strength, I would have said, you know, maybe the Heat could push it to 6-7. But now it's just tough. It's just tough. Especially with the way the Lakers are playing. They look like one of the most cohesive units I've ever seen. Because, you know, we talked all year, at least the LA media, talked about who is their third scorer. And as it turns out, literally everyone is their third scorer. Right. It's KCP one night. It's Danny Green another night. It's Rajon Rondo giving you four freaking threes another night. It's Markieff Morris coming off the bench and scoring. It's Kyle Kuzma doing it at times. It's Caruso doing it at times. I mean, there's literally a guy doing it every single night. And I think what so many of us were focused on, who is that one guy, that we didn't think, all right, it's just going to be a different guy every single game. Mm-hmm. And that's how they're going to win games. LeBron and AD are going to give you what they give you. And then they're going to get, you know, three or four threes from Danny Green. They're going to get two or three from Markieff Morris. They're going to apparently get three from Rondo, playoff Rondo, who can do that now. It's just been everybody. And that's why I think they're so hard to beat, because they really found a way to make their third scorer their entire lineup outside of LeBron and AD, which is impressive.
Yeah, I mean, it's these injuries suck, because really the bubble has been fantastic. I mean, it's been better than I think most of us could have realistically expected. But at the same time, these are like the perfect encapsulation of 2020. This final series, just having the air deflated out of it almost immediately. So I feel like it is the final series that 2020 deserves, unfortunately.
Yeah, this unfortunately feels like the way to go.
Yeah.
2020 has been pretty crappy.
Well, on that uplifting note, I think that is a good place for us to wrap up. So, Tomer, thank you again for joining us today. One more time, can you let our listeners know where they can find you on Twitter and where they can find your work?
Thank you guys for having me. I really appreciate the invitation and letting me talk some Clippers, some Doc Rivers, some coaching, and the NBA Finals. I really appreciate that. You guys can find my work at Tomer Azarly on Twitter and Instagram. That's at TomerAzarly. In fact, if you want to go see Doc Rivers roast me from earlier this season, you can hop over to my Instagram and see that. It's on my story. I tweeted it out last night as well. You can find my work at Clutch Points, at Clutch Points app on Twitter, but on the Clutch Points website, on my author page, I just wrote a nice little, you know, few thousand word piece on Doc Rivers and what I think happened. I took a personal approach to that article. And then, yeah, I also have a podcast called the Battle for LA podcast, where we talk about the Clippers, Lakers, and you know, some NBA topics as well. So visit that. We have Michael Cooper on next week. And so, yeah, that's pretty much it. That's pretty much it. Thank you guys again for having me.
For sure, man. And yeah, Clippers fans, I'm sure you're already following Tomer, but Sixers fans, if you're looking for some Doc Rivers intel, go check out his piece on Clutch Points. And I apologize in advance, Tomer, for how much I'm going to be blowing up your DMs to ask you some Doc questions over the next weeks, months, years, whatever it may be. But
that's all right. That's all right. I look forward to it.
Please follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bios to give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews, and we're being hosted by Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Until next time, I'm Brian Toporek, and I was joined, as always, by Morten Jensen and our special guest, Tomer Azarli. Have a good one, you guys.
You too, Brian. Don't die, man.